My dear Lord Brahma, because of material opulence, a foolish person becomes dull-witted and mad. Thus he has no respect for anyone within the three worlds and defies even my authority. To such a person, I show special favor by first taking away all his possessions. Purport. A civilization that has become godless because of material advancement and opulence is extremely dangerous. Because of great opulence, a materialist becomes so proud that he has no regard for anyone and refuses to accept the authority of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The result of such a mentality is certainly very dangerous. To show special favor, the Lord sometimes makes an example of someone like Bali Maharaj, who was now bereft of all of his possessions. Om Gyanatimarandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So after speaking about the verse, I'm going to give a report about my visit to the Angkor Wat temple in Cambodia, which I visited on my way to India. And actually there is a connection with Bali Maharaj, you know, as we'll see when we get to that. But just to review where we're at in terms of the overall picture being presented in the eighth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and we can see that the possession of the heavenly planets is a big matter of contention between the demigods and the asuras. If we go back to the beginning of this eighth canto, you know, the early chapters, we see that the demigods are in possession of the heavenly planets, but Indra creates an offense to Durvasa Muni. Durvasa Muni had offered him a garland, and he, rather than just accepting it and keeping it on his neck, he immediately took it off and gave it to his elephant. So the elephant, not really appreciating the garland, took it, slammed it to the ground, and trampled on it. And Durvasa Muni was offended by that. So he cursed Indra and the demigods. And because of that curse, they lost the heavenly kingdom to the asuras and Bali Maharaj. So the demigods went to Lord Brahma, and accompanied by the demigods, Brahma went to Svetadvip, you know, the ocean of milk, and got an interview with the Supreme Lord, Chirudakshayi Vishnu, who resides there. And the Lord advised the demigods to make a truce with Bali Maharaj and the demons, the asuras. And he proposed that he would make an arrangement for both sides to churn the ocean of milk in order to jointly make some nectar. So the demigods did that. They went to Bali Maharaj and they made a truce with the Asuras, and they began to follow the directions of the Supreme Lord to churn the ocean of milk. You know, they used the Mandara Mountain as a churning rod. They used the serpent Vasuki as a churning rope. And they started churning, but they found that the mountain was sinking into the ocean, so the Supreme Lord manifested his form as Kurma, the tortoise incarnation, and floating in the ocean of milk, he carried the Mandara Mountain on his back. So the churning then went on, and some poison was churned out of the ocean first, and Lord Shiva drank it up. And then finally, the nectar came. Of course, I'm abbreviating all of this. The nectar came, and Mohini Murti, the female form of the Lord, manifested for a specific reason, you know, to distribute the nectar. The Asuras were charmed by her, so they agreed to this proposal that she distribute the nectar. But despite their faith in her, she wound up giving it to the demigods, who then became very powerful. So then there was another, you know, battle. And the demons headed by Bali Maharaj were defeated in this battle. They tried to take the nectar back and reconquer the heavenly planets and everything like that, but they lost. And as a matter of fact, by the influence of Lord Vishnu, who took the side of the demigods in this battle that took place, Bali Maharaj and many of the Asuras were actually killed. They were made lifeless and unconscious. But Shukracharya, who we've been hearing about recently in these recent chapters, the spiritual master of Bali Maharaj, restored him and the Asuras to life. And then they began to perform sacrifices for Bali Maharaj. And Bali Maharaj, you know, pleased his spiritual master, so they perform what's called Vishvajit sacrifice, yajna. Vishvajit means conquer the universe. So because of that, Indra became a little bit concerned, and he consulted the spiritual master of the demigods, Bhrigupati, and Bhrihaspati. And he advised them, well, you can't win over them now. They're too powerful. So you should just go into hiding and let them take over until sometime in the future when things become more auspicious for you. So the demigods had to leave the heavenly planets, and Bali Maharaj conquered the whole universe. So that kind of brings us up to the whole pastime we've just been through, where Aditi, the mother of the demigods, prayed to get the kingdom back and have a son who would be able to help her achieve that goal. So Vamanadeva appeared, and using a little transcendental trickery, he got Bali Maharaj to give him the whole universe just by asking for three steps of land. So that kind of brings us up to the present moment where Bali Maharaj has been arrested by the Lord, and he's given away his whole kingdom, including the entire universe. And in one sense, it looks like a bad situation for him, as the Lord is explaining in this verse of the Bhagavatam. It's actually his mercy sometimes that he takes away everything from a powerful person, because if one possesses too much material opulence, then one becomes very proud and doesn't recognize any superior authority. And that is actually the, as Srila Prabhupada is indicating and hinting at the purport here, that's the condition of the current materialistic worldwide civilization, where, you know, they become very proud because of their so-called material advancement in science and technology. But, you know, sometimes when there's some disturbance and, you know, the material opulence is taken away and material miseries come, then sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes people turn back to God. So, yes, yaham anugrihnami harishye tad dhanam shanai, the Lord explains elsewhere, that the first installment of his mercy is sometimes to take away the opulence of someone, including even a devotee. So all of these events are taking place during the Chakshusha Manvantar period, which is, we're now in, that is the sixth Manvantar period. We're now in the seventh Manvantar period, which began about 120 million years ago. So the Chakshusha Manvantar period is before that. So it's a very ancient history. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is presenting the important events in the history of the universe, which, you know, this universe goes through vast cycles of creation and destruction, lasting billions and millions of years. So you can imagine in the course of billions and millions of years how many little insignificant things happen. Of course, in our daily newspapers and television news programs and web news services, you know, we encounter, you know, descriptions of so many events. And they may seem very important to, you know, people who are viewing them or reading them. They may get very worked up about them. But in terms of the larger scale of things, they're not really so significant. The most significant events in the history of the universe are the incarnations or the avatars of the Supreme Lord, who comes at different times. As Lord Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutani vidharmasya tadatmanam, what is that, srijamyaham. You know, when irreligion rises and the principles of religion decline, then I come to restore things. So these are the most important events in the history of the universe, and we find them recorded in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's a reminder, you know, that we're not just living in some accidental universe that manifested from some Big Bang. Lord Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita describes people who think like that. He says, Asatyam apratishtam te jagat ahur anishvaram aparasparasam bhutam kimanyat kamahaitukam. In the 16th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna explains, yes, there are some people who think there's no God in control of the universe. Everything is just happening in its own way. There's no real purpose, no real standard for human behavior. We just do whatever we want to do, motivated by our own desires. Kamahaitukam, he explains, our own material desires. That becomes the standard for behavior. And then we see what kind of world results. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that such people will think to gratify their senses from the beginning of life to the end is the main purpose of human existence, and they'll create all kinds of horrible things that are very destructive for the world. So we actually see that happening. So here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we're getting reminders that this world actually belongs to someone. It's the property of the Supreme Lord, Ishivasyam idam sarvam yat kincha jagatam jagat tena tyaktena bunjita magrita kasya svidanam. It's stated in the Sri Upanishad. Everything is actually the property of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's not there for you just to grab and take. And just like if you were to walk into a store and just think, this doesn't belong to anybody, it's just there for the grabbing and the taking, you'd find yourself arrested for shoplifting. So actually we have a whole world of shoplifters today. They're taking things without understanding who they belong to. Actually, everyone has a quota, and they're entitled to their quota, but not more than that. Once Srila Prabhupada in India was speaking with an industrialist who made glass, and Srila Prabhupada was inquiring from him how he makes the glass. And he said, well, you take silicon, which is sand, and you heat it up and you melt it. And he was explaining the whole process for making glass. And Prabhupada asked him, and then where do you get this sand? He said, well, but where does the sand come from? Prabhupada was making the point, the sand belongs to Krishna. So he called this industrialist a thief, you know, for taking Krishna's sand. So sometimes, in order to correct the mentality of people, even devotees, his own devotees, Krishna will deprive them of their opulence. And that's his mercy. But we're going to see that, as I said, Bali Maharaj is a very interesting character, personality, if you follow his whole story. But even though he's been deprived of everything, he's been arrested, he's going to be put into the Sutala subterranean planet. Krishna actually promises him that in a future manvantara, he will become Indra and he'll have control of all the heavenly planets again. And until that time, he's going to be waiting in Sutala, where Krishna says, I will personally be your bodyguard. I'll protect you and your family members from any harm, and you'll be living in great opulence there with me as your personal associate. So, although the Lord sometimes deprives persons of their material opulences, he also sometimes provides very wonderful facilities for them. Yoga Chamam Vahamyaham, the Lord states in the Bhagavad Gita, I provide the necessities for my devotees and their practice of bhakti yoga. So I'll stop there. Any questions on first? Yes.
Thank you for your class, Hare Krishna Prabhu. I just wanted to note that this whole thing happened in the heavenly planets. And I was thinking, in Kali Yuga, all the planetary system is also in Kali Yuga. Heavenly planets, middle planets, and hellish planets. So my question is... Lord Chaitanya appeared in Kali Yuga, in this Yuga, in this planet. So what grace of God do the heavenly planets or the hellish planets get in Kali Yuga?
I'm not sure about the premise of your question, you know, whether the influence of Kali Yuga is felt in the heavenly planets or whether it's just felt here. Does anybody have any insight on that? But it's a question that needs further research. But it seems how the residents of the heavenly planets get mercy during that time is that they come themselves, you know, to participate in the Lord's pastimes, you know, different demigods and higher beings from the higher planetary systems, they actually come and participate in the pastimes of the Lord. He actually calls them, you know, to take on different roles. So in that way, they get mercy. And it says so many places that the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra is so powerful. I think this question was raised by Haridas Thakur to Lord Chaitanya, saying that what if everybody becomes liberated in the whole universe? So that seems to be possible, that, you know, the influence of Lord Chaitanya can extend throughout the whole universe. Of course, the answer was that more souls will come, you know, because there's apparently always a number of souls that are misusing their free will and independence. Okay, so on my way to India, I stopped off in Cambodia to visit the Angkor Wat Temple. I'd wanted to do it for some time because I'd heard about this place, and I'd heard that it has a lot of cosmological and astronomical information built into the structure of the temple, and then it also has a lot of beautiful carvings related to Krishna's pastimes. So So this shows the location of Angkor Wat in the country of Cambodia. It was built, the temple there, it's a very huge Vishnu temple. It was built about 1,000 years ago. And we can see that at that time, the influence of Vedic culture had spread widely throughout Asia. Actually, all throughout Southeast Asia, you can find, you know, temples, Vedic temples, extending all the way into Indonesia. You know, like Bali is very famous for its temples. And also Java and places like that. So the Vedic culture had spread very widely throughout Asia. And there's a scholar named Eleanor Monica, you know, who's written a book about Angkor Wat, in which she explains a lot of the cosmological and astronomical information that has been built into the structure of the temple. And for that, you have to know something about the measurements of the temple. And the basic unit of measurement used in that time is called the cubit, which is the distance from the tip of the fingers to the elbow. Of course, people have different size arms, so you know you could have cubits of different lengths. But by carefully studying the measurements of the temple, you know, scholars have determined that the cubit that was used at Angkor is about 1.425 feet in length. Now, some of the measurements of the temple are related to the yugas. So the Kali Yuga is 432,000 years. The Dwapara Yuga is twice that, 864,000 years. The Treta Yuga is three times a Kali Yuga, 1,296,000 years. And the Satya Yuga is four times a Kali Yuga, 1,728,000 years. So when you enter the temple, you go across a stone bridge. I should say temple complex. You go across a stone bridge which crosses a moat. And that entrance bridge is 432 cubits long, which appears to be a reference to the Kali Yuga. It's like you're entering, you know, from the Kali Yuga into the sacred space of the temple. So when you come to the end of that bridge on the other side, there's a gateway. And when you walk through that gateway, there's another road, not a bridge, but a causeway that leads to the main temple buildings at the end of the causeway. And that walkway is 864 cubits long, which appears to be a reference to the Dwapara Yuga. Then there's another measurement that goes from the middle of the bridge to this point here, which is the entrance to what they call the third enclosure. And that measurement is 1,296 cubits, which appears to be a reference to the Treta Yuga. And then this measurement here, from the beginning of the western bridge to the entrance to the central deity complex, is 1,728 cubits, which appears to be a reference to the Satya Yuga. So there are all kinds of things like that built into, you know, the temple structure. So you can see the basic outline of the temple is it's like a square, you know, surrounded by a moat, and then in the center of it there's the actual temple. So going back out again to the entrance to the temple, like this is the bridge, and you see across the bridge this outer wall of the temple, which has a main gate here, and then over here there's a gate on the this side, and there's a gate over here on this side. So there's some interesting solar events that take place in the connection. If you come to Angkor Wat at sunrise on the spring or fall equinox, that's the time when the day and night are of equal length, and you look at towards this outer wall, the sun rises directly over this central tower. And then if you come, and then it also rises over the main tower of the temple, not just the entrance gate. So that's interesting. If you come on the winter solstice, which is the shortest day of the year, the sun rises over this far gate of the temple. And if you come on the summer solstice, the longest day of the year, the sun rises here. So this is all built into the structure of the temple, so that if you came, say, on December 22nd, you'd see the sun rise over this gate. And then in January, it'd be kind of over here. Each day through January and February, the sun would be rising more and more in this direction until on the spring equinox, it'd be rising directly over this tower. And then as you go through April, May, June, you know, the sun would be gradually rising in this direction until it would rise here on the summer solstice. And then after that, the sun starts going back through July, August, September, until September 23rd, it's again rising over the central tower. And then through October, November, and December, it gradually moves in this direction until it's there. So it shows these ancient people had quite detailed knowledge of astronomy. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, it says, on the four sides of the great mountain known as Sumeru are four mountains, Mandara, Meru Mandara, Suparshva, and Kamuda. So in the center of the Angkor Wat temple is this tower here, which represents Mount Meru, and it's surrounded by four other towers, which represent the mountains that, according to Srimad Bhagavatam, surround Mount Meru. And the moat here would represent the ring ocean that surrounds Jambudweep, which would be the central island. So this is a close-up picture of the central tower, which represents Mount Meru. When the temple was built, this tower would have housed a Vishnu deity. But in more recent times, you know, Buddhism has become dominant in Cambodia, so the deity they have in there now is a Buddha. Of course, who is an avatar of Vishnu, but originally there was a big deity of Vishnu installed in this temple in the central tower area. So basically, you know, the temple, it's like a depiction of Jambudweep surrounded by a ring ocean with Mount Meru in the center. So it's a cosmological map of the universe in addition to being a temple. So this here is called the third enclosure. You know, the outer wall here is like called the fourth enclosure. Then there's the third, the second, and finally the first, which is surrounds this central temple area. But this third enclosure wall is very interesting. It's got huge carvings on it. And you can see they're quite, it's quite big. You know, it's like hundreds of yards long here to here. And all four walls of this third enclosure are covered with stone carvings. The first one is a representation of the Battle of Kurukshetra. And as I said, you know, there's columns, and then there's the stone wall, and this whole area is the Battle of Kurukshetra. And it starts out with the Kurus on the left side and the Pandavas on the right side, and they're coming towards each other. So this shows the Kuru soldiers marching from the left. And you can see they're all marching in order, and they've got their weapons held at rest. And then as you go further along, as they come closer to the battle, they're no longer marching in strict order, and their weapons are raised. And then from the other side, you know, on the far right, you know, the Pandavas, you know, they're marching, you know, their foot soldiers are marching, and above them are their chariot warriors and, you know, main personalities like that. But as they get closer to the battle, again, they're no longer marching in order, their weapons are raised. This shows an elephant fighter. And then finally in the center, both sides meet, and it's a very chaotic battle scene, you know, that is depicted. And this shows a Pandava warrior putting a spear into the chest of a Kuru warrior. You can tell it's a Kuru warrior because his chariot is moving towards the right. And this is like a close-up of that, you know, a Pandava warrior attacking this Kuru warrior. You know, this is part of the central battle scene. And this figure was kind of interesting. It shows a Pandava chariot warrior. He's on the chariot. Here's the horse here. And here's the chariot driver. So it's sort of reminiscent. You know, we hear Krishna served as the chariot driver of Arjuna in the battle. I don't know that this is them. There are lots of chariots. But it's kind of interesting. And this shows Bhishma lying on the bed of arrows. And he delivered some teachings at that point, which we can find in Srimad Bhagavatam. So that's, you know, like as you're walking towards the third enclosure, that covers the right side of the wall. And then you come to a corner. And in the corner, there's a carving of Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill. So what makes this place so interesting? There's so many depictions of pastimes from the Srimad Bhagavatam and Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill. This one was a little harder to see. It's up high on a wall, but it's Rama shooting volley in his fight. Well, actually, he's shooting. There are actually two monkey soldiers here, two Vanaras. This is Sugriva, who Rama had made an alliance with, and this is Vali, who had taken away Sugriva's kingdom and stolen his wife. And Rama had made an alliance with Sugriva that if he would take his side in his battle with Vali, then Sugriva would help Ram recover Sita, his wife Sita, from Ravana. So in this picture it shows Ram shooting and hitting Vali with an arrow. And actually the first time that, I mean, Ram had a little bit of trouble deciding who was Vali and who was Sugriva. So he asked Sugriva to wear some special necklace so he could recognize him. But this shows him shooting Rama, shooting Vali. And then this is Vali lying down. He couldn't be killed, really, because he had a special necklace that had been given to him by Indra. But that shows Ram and Lakshman, Sugriva. And this is Vali with his wife Tara at his feet. And he comes to an understanding with Lord Rama. And these are some of the Vanaras, the monkey soldiers, who are looking at all these things happening. And this was a very kind of eroded carving, but it actually shows Rama shooting Maricha, who had disguised himself as a deer. Actually, I think I had gotten it. I was showing. And this is Ravana shaking Mount Kailash. Actually, there's a whole story behind that, but we're kind of running short on time. This is the king Suryavarma who built this temple. And then next comes some carvings showing the hellish planets and heavenly planets. It shows people marching towards the right. Then they come to Yamaraj, who's seated on a bull carrier. And Yamaraj directs them to Dharma and Chitragupta, who records the karma of the living entities. And then Chitragupta is sending them further on to the Yamadutas, who are casting some of them down into the hellish planets. And this goes on for about 100 yards, and there are 32 hellish planets depicted, including some of the ones that we see described in the Bhagavatam, like Kumbhipaka and Raurava and Maharaurava and so on. Yeah, this shows one of the hellish planets with different animals eating the people. And some of the souls are sent up to the heavenly planets. Of course, we don't want to go to either one, to the hellish planets or the material heavenly planets. But this shows, you know, the fate of those that go to the material heavenly planets. Now, what kind of connects this with Bali is this huge mural of the churning of the milk ocean. And this actually shows Bali Maharaj. He's got the head of Vasuki, And then come many asuras or demons. And then there's a large asura. And then some more regular-sized asuras. And then another large asura. And then some more. And then finally you come to the center where you've got at the bottom there's Kurma, and then there's Mount Mandara, and then there's Vishnu, and then at the top here there's Indra kind of steadying Mount Mandara. And then on the right hand, well, actually, it was kind of hard to take these pictures because there was some light shining and reflecting off the stone floor. But this shows what a nice depiction they made of Kurma Avatar. And then on the right-hand side, there are the devas, the demigods, pulling on Vasuki. And then there's a big deva here. And it's kind of interesting. It's actually Rahu disguised as a deva, a demigod. He's got these little fangs here that kind of give him away. And he's also got this little fuzzy beard that's carved on there, which shows that he's not actually a demigod. He's Rahu in disguise. And finally, at the end, there's Sugriva, who's got the tail of Vasuki in this depiction. So actually this representation of the churning of the milk ocean has some connection with this solar phenomenon as well. You know, if you actually look at it, on one side there's Bali plus 29 asuras plus one large asura plus another 29 asuras plus a large asura plus 30 more asuras, making a total of 91 asuras, which represent 91 days between the winter solstice and spring equinox. So they built some astronomical information into their representation of this pastime. Mount Mandara in the center represents the equinox, in this case the spring equinox, the celebration of which lasted 3 days, after which a new year starts. And then you've got Indra is a deva. He represents an extra day. And then on the other side where you have the devas, you've got Sugriva, 28 devas, a large deva, 28 more devas, another large deva, 29 devas, represents 88 devas, which correspond to the 88 days between the new year and the summer solstice. So the whole thing, if you multiply it out twice, it comes up to, you know, including Indra as the extra deva, it represents 365 days of the year. So that whole mural can be taken as representing the time it takes to go from the winter solstice to the spring equinox to the summer solstice. That's just the way they made it. You know, I think they took the existing pastime that's there in the Srimad Bhagavatam and decided to express it in a way that also represented some solar phenomenon. And this churning of the milk ocean is very popular in that part of the world. In the Bangkok airport in Thailand, there's this huge, colorful statue of this pastime of the churning of the milk ocean. Then there's another whole sculpture panel that represents the battle of Krishna and Banasura. This is Banasura with his many arms. And he was actually on a chariot. No, this is back to the temple of Angkor Wat. And then there's these two figures here, which appear to represent Usha and Aniruddha. Aniruddha was a grandson of Krishna. He had become in love with Usha, the daughter of Banasura, and had been captured by Banasura. So Krishna and his army came to battle Banasura to free Aniruddha, which they did. Then in the northwest corner of the Angkor Wat third enclosure, there's this picture of Garuda carrying Krishna and Satyabhama and the Manaparvata mountain. There had been... Yeah, it's a pastime that's explained in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the Krishna book, where Narakasura or Balmasura had stolen Maniparvata mountain, which was the playground of the demigods, and the earrings of Mother Aditi, the mother of the demigods, and some other things. And he'd also captured 16,000 princesses. So Krishna went with Satyabhama on Garuda to battle Narakasura, and they did that. And this triangular mark here kind of represents the Maniparvata mountain, which Garuda is carrying Krishna and Satyabhama back to Dwarka with. Then there's a huge panel that depicts the battle for Lanka. This is Ravana. And then this shows Rama carried by Hanuman. And this shows one of the monkey soldiers battling one of the Asura soldiers of Ravana. So you could just spend hours and days, you know, going through this temple trying to decipher all these sculptures. There's so many pastimes from the Srimad Bhagavatam and different depictions of Krishna and his various incarnations. So I'd wanted to visit this place for a while and finally had a chance to do it. Hare Krishna, thank you. Okay, one Bhrigupati. It's getting kind of late, so we'll just take one. Well, in the beginning, I showed that book by that scholar, Eleanor Manika. And, I mean, there are other books that you could use to guide yourself through the temple, or you could hire a guide. But I used that book as my main guide, you know, to the, especially the astronomical information and the yuga information and what was being represented, because sometimes it's kind of bewildering. You just see these huge murals with all these detailed sculptures on, and you can't really figure them out, you know. So it does help to have some kind of guidebook, but that's the book that I used. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.